Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today by two very special guests. Number one, part of the ExchangeWire team, research lead Matt Broughton. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Rachel. Lovely to be here as always.
Yeah, and good to have you in the guest seat for a change. And our very special guest, so that was special guest plus very special guest, is Luke Bristow, who's CEO at MNC. Luke, welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast.
Thank you, Rachel, for having me. Yeah, pleasure to be here.
And perhaps for listeners that aren't familiar with MNC, maybe you could just say a little bit about the agency and what
course,
you guys do.
Of course, yeah. So MNC, independent media planning buying agency, we've been around for just shy of 30 years. So not kind of new, and we haven't sprung up overnight. And specialise primarily in working with challenger brands. So that's kind of our sweet spot. Challenger brands being companies who are, for the most part, in a high growth stage and are anywhere between 20 million in annual revenue all the way through to about 250 million. It's kind of our sweet spot of those we work with. That being said, we do work with some larger and some smaller. And that, generally speaking, that's because they bring a similar type of ambition or kind of profile or motivation to how they approach media and how they approach their audiences. But yeah, that's the headline about us.
Fantastic. Well, really looking forward to some insights from an independent agency point of view on our stories this morning. Okay, so let's get started. First news story that I want to chat through with the two of you today is Apple reportedly losing 18 – no, sorry, not 18. That's my eyesight there. Apple reportedly – anyone that's working for Apple
is having a heart attack, if that was the case.
Exactly. Apple is reportedly losing $1 billion per year on its streaming service, still a significant amount of money. And that is, according to reports from The Information, it's the only part, allegedly, of the Apple service which isn't profitable. When I'm talking about Apple service, I'm sort of excluding hardware there, although I'm sure they're running still a very profitable business in the hardware space as well. But I'm referring to iCloud, Apple Music and App Store. The service was launched back in 2019, around the same time as Disney Plus. And I suppose you could argue, therefore, that it's late to the market in comparison with Netflix and Amazon Prime. But I think it's really interesting that it was launched at the same time as Disney Plus, who's got a slightly different story to tell in terms of profitability, right? Apple TV Plus doesn't currently operate a wide-scale ad-supported revenue model. It does carry some ads for live sports streaming, but that's it. It's obviously, allegedly part of its original business plan was that the company claimed that they would be loss-leading for about approximately the first 10 years of service. So where it, you know, if they start launched in 2019, we're now a good solid nearly 6 years into launch. And, you know, part of its strategy allegedly from early on was to lean on Apple's sort of premium quality branding and funneling obviously all of its investment into producing high quality original content. However, as I mentioned, you know, one of its rivals, Disney Plus, achieved profitability in 2024 sooner than was expected. So my question to you, and I'm going to come to you first, Luke, is what do you make of these results? Is it a bit of a surprise? And how do you think Apple needs to sort of structure itself from a strategic point of view to deal with this very competitive marketplace and perhaps move to profitability down the line?
Mm, yeah, no, great. It's a really interesting topic. I suppose to answer the first question you just laid out there, it's not a surprise. They've laid out kind of their plan, and it's quite a deliberate play from them that it's, I think they probably have avoided calling it a loss leader too often because I don't think that plays too well with the markets. However, it's a play whereby they're taking their time, right, about this. And there's a couple of different reasons for that. You know, Netflix had first mover advantage, you know, Disney had the brand equity at play and, you know, a huge library to kind of backfill. Amazon, you know, and Prime migrated a huge audience over onto Prime from kind of their existing subscriber base. So it's not a surprise that they are behind in this arms race, if you like, for subscribers. But, you know, 25 million in global subs. They have, as you've noted, intentionally been playing this kind of brand ecosystem play, if you like. you know, Apple is a very kind of premium product. They want to be in a race to the top, not a race to the bottom. And I think investing really heavily in their shows like, you know, your Severance or your Good Morning Show and, you know, really high award-winning content is all part of this kind of halo effect that they have on their brand as a whole. And they're hoping, and I guess to kind of like keep their customer base attracted within that ecosystem, right? So I guess, you know, the question comes not, you know, do you back them to eventually reach profitability, but do you back that this ecosystem play is a winner or not? Because it's a trade-off, right? Like they're not making money. However, having said that, you know, a billion, it's a huge amount of money when you talk about it, but in many ways, it's a bit of a balance sheet flex from them. You know, they're sat on 60 billion in cash, right? You know, when it represents a comparable to what they're actually earning year on year, you know, it's, you know, a billion loss represents less than 1% of their net profit, right? So in that kind of lens, you can be seen as much more of a strategic play rather than we need to turn profitability overnight in order to compete.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective on it. So from your point of view, do you see them expanding any of its advertising offering in this part of the business?
Yeah, I think they will. You know, they're not shy about kind of talking about advertising in the future. You know, they have experimented with advertising in some of their live streaming services. Likewise, you know, App Store and Apple Search, you know, they've got advertising capabilities within them. So, you know, as a business, they're not against advertising, but I think, you know, they want to make sure that they are not just trying to play the exact same game as Disney and Netflix and Prime, because they're one quite far behind them all, right? And I think to try and catch up with competing with that audience and competing with that ad model is going to be challenging. And I think they don't need to, right? I think they want to, as I've said, be in a race to the top, not a race to the bottom. They're going to be playing very much off this premium audience. They've got high quality shows and therefore they probably will be going after a much more premium CPM. So it won't be for every brand. It won't be for every advertiser when they do launch, but you can bet there'll be shareholder pressure in due course
along
for them
the
to
way.
Start monetizing this, to start investing in other areas of the business that they can, you know, bring revenue in, and advertising is the most obvious one of those.
What do you think, Matt? Is, you know, are we going to see pressure being put on Apple and its, you know, either its revenue model or its strategic positioning to think about beefing up its ad offering? Do you think it can catch the likes of its competitors, or do you think it's just going to, you know, continue playing in its lane and do it to the best of its ability?
Yeah, I think it's probably going to do that latter option of playing in its lane, because it's done very well at that so far. Yes, it's lost, you know, a billion a year, but it's only been spending about 5 billion on that compared to the likes of Netflix, which is spending 26 billion a year. So it's a much, you know, lower outlay. And of course, it's not just a standalone business. They're looking at Apple TV and going, okay, how can it bring consumers into Apple TV, their hardware, or how can it bring them into the rest of the Apple ecosystem? So in that sense, it's not necessarily that much of a loss leader, as they're obviously avoiding categorizing it as. In terms of the ads, I think, yeah, that's probably a sensible play for them, just to kind of boost that profitability a bit more. But they're going to be very careful at that, because what they have been very successful at doing is getting that critical acclaim for a lot of their shows. And if you kind of look at how Netflix was, it was kind of further down the line at Netflix, their own shows started to get that critical acclaim and, you know, over what they were getting from third parties. Obviously, that third party play is not necessarily a thing anymore, because everyone's got their own walled gardens and their own streaming platforms and that access to content. So they have to do it in-house, and they're doing very well at that. They've got really good viewing, really good ratings, really good critical reception. So I think they're kind of just going to carry on as they are. Yes, maybe bolster the profitability via the ads, but I don't think executives are looking at that and going, oh, this is a really bad thing, especially when, you know, if you compare to another big tech stablemate, Meta, in terms of their metaverse efforts with Reality Labs, that's lost $60 billion and hasn't turned a profit at all. And obviously a loss of $1 billion a year It makes it look like the bargain of the century.
Yeah, it's a really good point. So I suppose there's a couple of things that spring to mind there on the back of what you've just said, Matt. What if they were to start investing more in original content? Because the original content's not a cheap game, right? And before Netflix launched their ad model, we used to debate often here at Exchange Wire about whether they would go into ads or not, because they'd infamously said for so long that that wasn't what they were going to do and that they were going to still rely on their subscription model. But at some point, the amount of investment into producing this content just got too much to bear. So I guess there's that point. What if they start investing more money in original content to remain competitive? And then the second point is, you know, some of the other incumbents, Netflix being one of them, Disney Plus being one of them, but maybe also Amazon somewhere along the line, have got lots of partnerships with other content providers, right? Mm. Bringing them into their platforms. Mm. And that was a huge boost for Disney when they added Hulu to the mix, because they brought on board a whole lot of subscribers. So I suppose, classic Rachel Compound question here, Matt. What happens if they invest more money? And I'm going to pose this to you too, Luke. What happens if they invest more money in content? How do they make that stack up? And could you see the possibility of them bringing some kind of partners on board to retain that competitive edge in terms of content?
Yeah, I don't think they're going to necessarily go for the same scattergun approach that Netflix is now doing, simply given it's already spent a hell of a load on content and wants to obviously just reinforce what they've already got. I think they still will go for the more kind of targeted investments in terms of, let's have these real premium shows, let's fit what works, as Luke said earlier, in terms of, you know, Apple's brand identity with having that premium feel and premium look. In terms of bringing on third parties, I wouldn't be surprised if it explores more sporting leagues. Obviously, it's got the partnership with MLS in the US, and it's kind of, obviously sports isn't cheap, but equally it's a good way of bringing on board new audiences in what is probably a comparable price now in terms of these real, like, you know, premium TV shows. I wouldn't be surprised there. In terms of third parties, I think it's only if it really fits in with Apple's brand. I don't think they're going to be, you know, going for a Hulu or, you know, even say like an Amazon Prime, how they've been buying up film studios. Yeah. I don't necessarily see that unless it's a real targeted approach.
Luke, what do you think on that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly with Matt, actually. I mean, I think they're sticking to their strategy. I think, you know, whether or not you think that strategy is working, I think, you know, they are being backed on it. So it, as far as many of the kind of execs are seeing it, it's probably working in terms of the 10-year plan, building that ecosystem, keeping the customers in. I'm sure that they probably have ambitious acquisition targets for new subscribers in the coming years, which they'll need to invest properly into initiatives to get them on board via original content. You know, there could be a world in which they make more aggressive plays depending on market factors. So, you know, they're not going to do this scattergun approach of just licensing content left, right and center just to try and capture everyone. You know, there's a statement that I noted down in prep for this meeting that Apple TV is a Michelin star restaurant in a world of buffets, which is maybe a little bit unfair on Apple that it's not hyper specialist, because, you know, it's 25 million subs comparable to 100 odd million for its peers. It's not dwarfed by them in that sense, but, you know, it's gone very kind of boutique, it's gone very premium, and I think it needs to kind of like own that in a way. So maybe it's not quite a Michelin star restaurant, but it's high end, and I think they need to kind of continue to adopt that if they're going to, you know, win in this market, because they don't want to be in a race to the bottom with the others, as we've said. They want to be kind of having the most premium audience. They want that to work with a halo effect on their wider brand ecosystem. Who knows? In a future scenario where 2027, 2028, you know, they're looking shy of the targets that they've got in their 10-year plan, who knows? Maybe there'll be a world in which they make a play at acquiring a Paramount library or something like that, because there are others that are out there that, you know, could be up for grabs. And if they felt that it kind of aligns with their ethos, their values, everything else that kind of that works for them, then it wouldn't be a huge surprise. But I think for now, they're probably going to stick to their guns and say that this is working and let's kind of keep our heads down and keep pushing it.
Yeah. And I think the other thing, someone pointed this out to me recently, we weren't talking about TV, we were talking about some other part of the advertising market. It's, you know, it's not that bad to have a smaller share of a very competitive market. No. Because if, you know, if the rest of your business stacks up appropriately, even, you know, in this instance that we've discussed that, you know, Apple's making a loss on that part of the business, but they're not on other parts of the business. And if you've got a sufficient long-term strategy, even if it's not to dominate, even if it's just to still take that Michelin star budget, that's a budget, right?
I mean, Netflix has to be profitable, right? Because that is its core business, right? And you could argue the same. Although Disney's got franchises, it's got theme parks, it's got various other kind of, you know, franchises and IPs that it kind of like monetizes. But it is still, you know, entertainment and content is still kind of its core proposition. Whereas for Apple, it's hardware and tech, right? That is its core. That's where it really makes its money. That's how it's built that, you know, multi-trillion valuation, right? That's how it's built its 60 billion balance sheets, not off content yet. And I'm sure, you know, they want to be able to have a monopoly over everything, but they're not seeing it as kind of this money spinner for them. Whereas their peers have to, right? Because it is their core.
It's their main game.
It's their main game, right? So they are in an advantageous position in that sense that they can be much more considered. They don't need to rush things. They can take their time as they're doing, right? You know, when they're exploring original content, they don't need to rush stuff out to market that can, you know, as you could argue that maybe Prime did with Rings of Power, which, you know, although it was, you know, 400 million, 500 million, I think was speculated, spent on those shows and, you know, had mixed reviews, I think, let's say, whereas I think Apple, generally speaking, has had winners for the most part in what it's done. And I think that's probably testament to the fact that they have taken their time and they haven't had to rush things out for the sake of meeting certain targets or growth or audience acquisition.
Yeah, super fascinating. I've got lots more questions, but no time. So let's move on to the second story of the week. Perplexity AI in talks to raise funds at an $18 billion valuation. That's where I got my $18 billion from before. $18 billion valuation. That's $18 billion US dollars for the valuation. They're looking to expand their operations and meet growing demand for search tools. And discussions have included raising somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion US dollars for this particular funding round. It's an enormous amount of money. However, this is a moving from one competitive game to the next. This is a very competitive space. The world of anything to do with AI, but very specifically talking about LLMs and any kind of search tools. The company says with this investment that they'd focus on innovation and growth, but also they announced back in February that they will be launching a web browser called Comet, which is clearly direct competitor to Chrome, Safari, any other browsers out there in the market. So it feels likely that their main aim here is to sort of outpace the competition to become the search or LLM tool of choice. They operate an interesting ad rev share program with publishers. So that's and content providers. So that's one of the things that they use to try to differentiate themselves from their nearest competitors, returning revenue back to publishers and content providers whose content is obviously being used to inform and improve Perplexity results. And it also obviously operates a subscription model as well, which again some of its peers do. So I guess my questions here are, can it compete with LLM AI rivals in a very similar thread to our previous conversation? And of course, in this instance, we'll be talking mostly about ChatGPT and Gemini, but there'll be others out there too. And what will the revenue model look like from here onwards? And is there more space in the marketplace for competition around LLM style search tools? Matt, I'm going to come to you first on this one.
Yeah, so to answer your first point, you know, they raised $9 billion back in December, and you know, at a $9 billion valuation, sorry, and now they're raising at an $18 billion valuation 3 months later. I would, if I was investing in it, I'd bloody well hope it allowed me to compete better at those lofty valuations. And I think it's reflective of the kind of excitement around generative AI at the moment. But increasingly more and more, I'm starting to think, where are the individual moats for these generative AI platforms? They're all kind of, every one of them's got an image generator now, and every one of them has got search functionality. Obviously, OpenAI has that important first mover advantage, and I think Perplexity has been, you know, obviously going more for that search angle, which obviously could pay off, but equally, you've got Google lurking in the background, and given their resources, anything that Perplexity does in terms of, okay, this you know, this has revolutionized search, which I don't think it quite has yet, but it could. Anything that it does, Google will just go, yeah, we'll take that idea. We've got more than enough money in the bank to invest in that. Obviously, yeah, a valuation of $18 billion is huge, but not compared to the cash that Google has in the bank. So yeah, obviously DeepSeek was an absolute thunderbolt to these platforms, and in terms of these valuations, given that they're able to build that platform at a fraction of the cost. So yeah, I think it could be competitive, but equally I'm starting to think, how are these platforms going to differentiate from each other going forward?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, right? Because it does feel like search is the sort of intersection point at which they are competing. And I don't know about you guys, we talk about it all the time here in the office, but you know, LLMs are becoming default search engines for most people on a day-to-day basis. So what, Luke, I'm going to come to you. How do you see things panning out for Perplexity? And I'm also interested just to understand your perspective from a brand point of view, I suppose on the point of differentiation that Matt mentioned earlier on, and on what the value is for, you know, in the advertising opportunities, what the value is for brands in that environment.
Yeah, great. Well, I had a similar take to Matt actually in terms of the threat from Google and whether there is enough of a crack in the space generally for Perplexity to break through, because you know it's not just Google that, you know, with Gemini and kind of other investments that they've made that are, you know, almost the status quo to go for in this place. You know, OpenAI and their partnership with Microsoft recently means that that's going to be very, very hard to break. And actually the only way that you can see, even with £1 billion kind of pounds of backing, which will bring a lot of expectations attached to it in a very different way to the Apple conversation we just had of expectations of growth and adoption, it's going to be very hard to kind of make a real dent in that. So, I mean, you've seen early shoots from Perplexity in the sense of it's a very highly trusted platform. I think the way that they've been very transparent about sources and things like that have meant that there's been really good early adoption. I think the UX is very strong and actually far superior to your traditional search engines, the Googles of this world. And that's why you've seen a lot of good early adoption. However, I would say the reason that I have a niggle in my mind as to like whether there is a kind of a real potential for it to kind of cut through is, yes, in offices like this and kind of environments where people are very early adopters, you know, we will be using LLMs all the time, right? I use multiple. In our business, we use Claude, we use Grok, we use ChatGPT, right? Use Perplexity for various different things, and they've got various different uses and benefits that complement the existing requirements of any business, right? But if the opportunity here for Perplexity is enterprise, which it has to be really, they need to step up from being a tool to being a platform, right? That's how they're going to really properly monetize. They've got to compete with the fact that Google is already integrated across, you know, Chrome and YouTube and Android and everything else, and actually breaking that market for Perplexity. They've really got to say what they are doing that's completely different, that makes it a need to have for a business, not a nice to have. And I think for us at the moment, experimenting with it, I appreciate it's relatively early days and, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but for MNC, we're experimenting with all of these. And I would say Perplexity kind of fits that nice to have category, but if we lost it tomorrow, we'd be fine. And I think probably most businesses would see Perplexity as that. So they've really got to think about, okay, what is our category differentiator here? And if it's trust, because, you know, there is some cracks in Google's kind of, you know, general kind of trust attached to them in the sense that, you know, they've, whilst they own 90% of the search market, you know, they've got monopoly lawsuits coming against them.
For left, right, and center.
You know, they've broken antitrust laws in Europe
everywhere,
and Australia. So, you know, there's a lot going against them. But I think that sits at quite a high level, right? For your end consumer,
They don't care.
They don't care that Google's got an antitrust lawsuit coming against them from Europe, right?
Unfortunately,
they don't
know. Not.
No. So it's like, they're blazoned still on the homepage. Google search. We're being sued. Yeah. Like, no, it's not quite there yet.
So for your average user that doesn't sit in an office talking about tech every day, they will still default to Google, right? Yeah. And they still will continue to do that. So how do you convince them to use Perplexity in a different way and promote its benefits and really own that? And then for businesses, which is where the real opportunity is, if you're going to grow and capitalize on that billion investment, like you really need to convince business leaders that, like, in terms of a stack, how does it complement that wider stack? Because maybe search is fragmenting, right? And there is an opportunity for, you know, in the future, multiple players sitting there, a bit like we have when it comes to, you know, using mail and you know, Zoom and various kind of different tools that we'd have for kind of office operations, there might be a world in which, you know, we have different LLMs and search functionality for different kind of purposes, but that's yet to be defined. And I think, you know, if they want to, you know, fulfill upon these valuation expectations, they really need to figure that out quite quickly, I would say.
And then also, bearing all of that in mind, then from an advertising point of view, that doesn't really feel like a, you know, an area where many advertisers are going to want to invest money, because who are they reaching in that environment? Still very fragmented. If it's not going to be, you know, integrated and become part of a platform play, then what's the point?
Yeah. It's I mean, we could talk about this forever, to be honest, but yes, I think it's an area that I don't think advertisers want to experiment in just yet, because it's too unpredictable, it's changing too quickly. I think whilst some kind of more innovative or experimental ones will probably consider how, you know, LLMs kind of do fit within their advertising and general kind of advertising mix and media planning mix, for now I don't think it's front of mind at all. The place that it does have an impact, let's say, is when it comes to brand building, right? So I think an authority, because if you look at the LLMs at the moment, and you can even ask an LLM, right? You can go into a ChatGPT and say, if I put a query into you and say, who is the best media agency in the country, or what is the best crisp brand that I can buy from? They all have different kind of, you know, ways in which they pull and scrape this data. But generally speaking, it will come from high authority places, so publications with high respect, and also ones that have a reputable brand, right? So the ones that have a reputable, well-known brand will be preferred by the LLMs to be put forward when your end user says, which is the best crisp brand that I want to buy? So whilst it might not influence how you buy and plan advertising within the search itself, it might influence how much you invest in your brand versus your performance or activation. Because if you know that by investing in your brand and therefore appearing in high, it's good for PR, like appearing in high credible publications means that you are more likely to be recommended by an LLM from an end user asking about, you know, which shop should I go to today to get my groceries, then yeah, it has an implication on advertisers, but maybe just more indirectly.
Yeah, but that's super interesting though, because it is the, you know, I feel like it's one of the reasons that people are using LLMs for search rather than relying on web browsers, because there's too much search advertising in those
trusted
browsers,
right?
And so it feels more trusted, right? Yeah, absolutely. Matt, some final perspectives on this story. One question I had for you is, therefore, taking all this into account, although that is, it's a double valuation from their last fund raise, and so that feels like quite a stretch, is this Perplexity going, we need to stack more cash as soon as possible to even make any of this competitive angle possible?
Yeah, I think in terms of how they framed the fundraise, it's around building that search functionality and competing with Google. Like if you go on to whether it's Perplexity, whether it's ChatGPT, some searches it's just like, whoa, this is so much better than what Google could provide. And it's not like I have to go searching down way below the fold for a link that's actually relevant. But equally, there's a lot of searches which, you know, generative AI platforms aren't quite there yet on, like in terms of the transactional searches. Like if you were to like go on ChatGPT, like I was playing around with earlier, search for a flight, it reads like one of those old fashioned recipe pages where it's just like millions and millions. Yes, Qantas is an airline. This place does flights from here to here. Aer Lingus is an airline. And it's just like, no, that wouldn't replace what I would go onto Google where I'd search. And obviously prices for a particular flight would come up. So I think in terms of that transactional piece, I think that's where search, you know, generative AI platforms need to improve on. And maybe that's what this investment is going for as well. Mm. And in terms of how, obviously in terms of these massive generalist platforms coming into the market, I don't think we're going to see new ones coming in. I think it's going to be a fight between the Perplexities, the Geminis, the OpenAIs. But maybe further down the line, we may start to see more vertical specialist platforms, whether they, you know, it be in these, you know, transactional searches or in just particular verticals, rather than we don't need to scrape every single novel that's ever been written, but we do want
we
to have a look at travel
in
information.
Area.
So,
yeah.
You know,
and
sticking
that's where
with that
first
example,
data is going to come. So
exactly.
Important, right? Because if you own that proprietary data and you can feed that into well, an LLM in a way, or an SLM, right, a small language model, like, then that will be really valuable to maybe a smaller set of customers or end users. But in certain verticals, you're talking high net worth, high, really valuable customers. If you're a brand and you have, you know, all the data attached to a particular, you know, industry, for instance, or a particular interest, and you can, you know, put that into an LM where someone, an end user, can search for it and find really valuable information from it that they're not going to get from something that's completely open source, then that could really change the game and fragment it, but in a really positive, different way.
Yeah. And presumably, because you mentioned two other LLMs that you're using at the moment, presumably, and you said you're using a variety for a range of reasons, presumably some of them are better at things than others. Starting to see some of that sort of specialism come through?
Yeah, so like Claude we use, that's much more for modeling and building out kind of more sophisticated plans, if you like, when it comes to inputting data and numerical values. ChatGPT is great for kind of creativity and copywriting and other things like that. And, you know, I certainly kind of personally find it really valuable for producing, whether it's a job spec in, you know, a tenth of the time that it would have taken to do it this time last year, right? Or whenever. So like there's loads of uses for that. And then Perplexity is really great on deep research and kind of like, you know, being able to find and identify the sources. So yeah, I think at this time, each of them are playing a very distinct role. But as I kind of mentioned at the start of this topic, I think for it to kind of have a real place in that kind of long-term ecosystem, I think making sure that you are need to have, not nice to have, is essential.
I agree. Got to move on. Third story on the podcast for discussion today is ISBA releasing their responsible media guide. ISBA, the marketing association here in the UK, has released a responsible media guide to provide their members, brands and other media buyers with some practical guidance on how they can maximise control over safe, suitable and legal placement of their advertising across a variety of media channels. The guide is only available to ISBA members, but we are told it's got five sections sharing advice on addressing challenges of brand safety, media suitability, inclusion, data and digital governance, and AI, which sounds like it covers the spectrum of concerns that would be facing brands and buyers. They're also developing a measurement tool in conjunction with the framework so that brands can benchmark their progress, I suppose, and benchmark their experience in trying to control these areas of responsible media buying. So this sounds like a fantastic tool available to ISBA members. I've got a few questions on this. Obviously, I'm going to come to you first here, Luke. I'm really keen to hear what an agency's response to this is and how useful you think it's going to be for maybe some of your clients or brands in general. But I'm also really interested on the sort of trajectory of responsible media buying. I feel like it was something that we've been, you know, that was the topic du jour about two, three years ago, really talking about brand purpose and how all advertising businesses, but specifically brands, had really started to prioritise issues around social responsibility and brand purpose. And so it felt like responsible media was a topic that we were talking about everywhere. It feels as though that's got less of a light shone on it these days, but perhaps not the case for you because it's part of your day-to-day activities, no doubt. But it feels like the advertising industry in general has sort of shifted its focus to other things, AI being one of them, like, oh my God, how is this going to impact our industry and, you know, what do we need to know about it? So I'm keen to understand how practical a guide like this might be and whether it's going to be, you know, sort of useful for the industry in a more general sense. And then my follow-on question from that is I'm interested in the exclusivity of it. Like, I think obviously ISBA needs to provide value to its members, but I'm just interested in thoughts on whether actually it would be more valuable if it was available to a wider audience. And I guess it raises questions of standardization as well, right? So especially if there's a measurement tool or a benchmarking tool associated with it, what does that look like if you're not an ISBA member versus an ISBA member?
All great questions. So I guess first and foremost, I think it's a really positive thing that this is, you know, an initiative that's gone out into the world, albeit to a relatively select audience of members. You know, it's a signal of maturity from the industry. I don't think it's a flash in the pan kind of moment again, where we'll see a spike and then kind of dip. You know, it's yes, I think a few years back there was a lot more talk about, you know, brand purpose and you know, corporate social responsibility had kind of a new identity attached to it that was, and the reason for that being, I think a lot of brands were seeing commercial success off the back of investing in CSR. And I think that's what underpins a lot of my kind of views attached to not just this report, but kind of corporate social responsibility and investments and initiatives of this in general, because I think that's what drives business as a whole. And I think that's what drives advertisers as a whole. It's what drives agencies as a whole. And the industry moves forward when we are united against kind of, you know, commercial intent, not just, you know, doing the right thing, I guess. So I guess, so that's kind of like a couple of headlines attached to this. You know, I think my views on the challenges that I think that come with this are adoption risk. And I think that's partly, as you've noted, because it kind of sat behind a paywall, essentially. You know, if you're not a member, you can't access it. And therefore, you know, you're not, very few brands that I speak with, certainly, who might not be members or might not have agencies who are members, are going to sign up off the back of this. I don't think there's enough incentive for them to do so. And to be totally honest, I think part of the cynic in me is those that are already invested enough to be reading this kind of material are probably already acting relatively responsibly anyway. So it's a bit of a, you know, a virtuous circle, you could argue in some senses, but quite a closed off virtuous circle where, you know, those that are doing good and thinking, you know, responsibly about how they buy plan media and, you know, their, whether it's their carbon footprint or their DE&I or their use and adoption of AI, you know, those that are thinking about the positive impact that they can have with that will be reading this anyway, yeah. And those aren't probably won't. So adoption risk is one of the biggest concerns that I've got from this. And then that leads into a greater question in terms of, you know, how can we better incentivize people to use it? So how can we flip the conversation from we should be buying ethically to we profit by buying ethically, right? I think there's a number of different things that we can do to both advertisers and agencies to better increase adoption for, you know, CSR initiatives. But I think the biggest one being, you know, if we can tie it to the bottom line, if we can tie it to commercial intent, then that will be the needle mover rather than just education of this is the right thing to do or on here's some guidelines. Here's another playbook in terms of, you know, how this can be used. Because another concern attached to doing anything that is a standalone report is that pretty much the day that it's published, it's out of date, right? Mm. So someone picks this up in 6 months' time, it's not evolved with the times. When you're talking about things like AI, as we've just covered, you know, it moves at the speed of light.
Absolutely.
Right, so you've got a report that says how you should be adopting and adapting your media planning or your corporate structure to inherit this and to make sure that you are doing good, but you'll be questioning immediately whether it's the right thing today if it was 6 months ago or 12 months ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that also, you know, makes me think about if we accept that part of the reason to adopt responsible media code in general is in order to protect not just sort of brand safety and brand suitability, but also to sort of protect the ecosystem. So if we accept that especially advertising is a value exchange for good quality publishing and, you know, well-regarded, well-researched content, then making sure that money is invested appropriately is upholding the sort of morality of that entire part of the ecosystem. And I think we probably all felt like that was what was being attacked when a lot of advertisers felt they needed to remove their investment from social media platforms, specifically X. Obviously that row unfolded over in the US between Elon Musk and the advertising or the you know, brand association that was removing spend from the platform. And that felt like a moment in time that actually, as an industry, advertisers have got the right to put their money wherever they want, and they shouldn't be, you know, they shouldn't be strong-armed into spending their money on any particular platform. But then in general, if we sit back and take a look at the quality of those platforms and the content that's provided on those platforms, how does that make us feel as an industry and as a society? And then how do we keep upholding and ensuring that we've got reasonable business models and monetization models associated with people that are just getting on with providing factual, good quality content? It's all linked. linked, right? And if, as you say, as you said, you know, there's a code which is a great thing, or a guide which is a great thing, but only available to a small subsection of the community, it just doesn't feel like we're even touching the sides there. That would be sort of, yeah, one of my bigger concerns. Matt, what's your perspective on this story?
Yeah, I completely agree with what you've said and what Luke said in terms of it's, you know, anything that can be helpful to brands, it's a good thing. It should be applauded. And I'm so pleased to see inclusion factored in into the guide, given the obviously ongoing US rollback against anything to do with DEI, yeah. Which is obviously a huge shame. And also it's good that, you know, practical guidance on AI has been included. Obviously it's so nascent and so cutting edge that anything that can help brands, even if it is a tremendously small subset, separate the meaningful from the bullshit in terms of what will inevitably be starting to be sold. Oh yeah, we've got an AI platform, this will help. Actually, no, if you're able to help draw the difference out, that can be a huge help. But yeah, obviously it's all going to be moot if X decides, hang on, this is an industry body trying to help its members, let's sue them and, you know, lead to the disbandment of ISBIRTH, which obviously, you know, very much hope that doesn't happen, and hope their court case against, I know they've recently brought more advertisers into it, I hope it gets thrown out and told never to ever pursue anything like this ever again. But yeah, hopefully that's not the case. And obviously, you know, in terms of this guide, it's not necessarily as, you know, technically controversial as, say, if they were rolling out new tech standards across the industry. But it does raise some questions about the involvement between, you know, the big tech platforms and industry bodies. Meta is an ISBA member, and obviously they've been having a massive rollback of their DEI efforts and also rowing back on a lot of their brand safety controls, which obviously raises some uncomfortable questions. But yeah, all in all, I think the guide is a good, solid idea. And if it helps even just one brand, happy days. But yeah, I just think there are wider industry questions around it.
And, you know, which are maybe not necessarily solvable, pardon me, just by, for example, making the guide more widely available, yeah, or having conversations such as these around the point of responsible media guides and, you know, achieving some sort of unified understanding of that across the industry. I can appreciate that there's, you know, lots of levers being pulled in different directions here. But that was one of the things that came to my mind too, Matt, was, you know, what's the read across between producing guides like this and maybe the work that IABs do, you know, who tend to have a lot more technical organisations in the forefront of their membership. How could we maybe draw those efforts together to make something a little bit more accessible across the piece? Further to the point that you mentioned earlier on, Luke, which is that you want to be able to tie media responsibility to profitability. And I remember that was a real pain point in conversations when we were having them, for example, at ATS London a couple of years ago, around environmental sustainability and other, you know, socially responsible ways of buying media, is how do you deal with that potentially inherent contradiction between wanting to do the right thing and needing to do the right thing for business purposes. So it would be great if we turned our attention to that as much as possible to make it as practical as possible, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not going to be overnight, right? I think we can accept that this is going to be a relatively slow moving change, because it's behavior change, it's behavior adoption by kind of senior decision makers at a business level. So which unfortunately is just never that quick, especially for something that is regulatory like this. However, I think what I can speak to is from some experience with the kind of brands that we tend to work with at MNC and the kind of the challenger profile. So challengers by nature, you know, they want to do the right thing. Generally speaking, you know, they come from a background where they are more progressive, you know, they've grown up for the most part in quite a digital first, quite modern world, and see the world in a positive way. However, you know, when in a cutthroat world whereby you have to, you know, survive or die, if you like, you know, challengers want to do the right thing, but not if it slows growth, right? So that kind of comes back to the point around, you know, can we not only educate on the benefits of investing in any of these initiatives that has been put forward with this guide, but how can we actually as a body, as an industry, so you mentioned IAB or others, come together to say, what are the, you know, the creative or strategic ways in which as an industry, we could better incentivize against initiatives into this. So again, I'm not going to say that I've got all the answers to this, but, you know, could we broach conversations around preferential deal terms, you know, for those who are investing in more green initiatives, for instance, or who do have scores of DE&I that are of particular nature, right? You know, those with low carbon footprints could get kind of CPM rebates or inventory credits. Like, again, these are, you know, against the wall, just chuck everything up there and kind of see what sticks to start with. But I don't know how much that conversation's happening. I don't know who's responsible for that kind of initiative. I think at the moment, everyone's looking out for themselves. And I suppose that's where these kind of boards and bodies step up. It's not just about kind of, here's a nice guide that we produced. By the way, you have to be a member in order to see it. And, you know, if you're not, then good luck. You know, that doesn't really solve it, right? That doesn't help, you know, the industry as a whole. So if we can think about ways that we can, one, engage everyone and educate everyone on the benefits, profitable commercial benefits of investing in initiatives like this, great. And then also start a conversation about how do we, over the longer term, maybe change the system to incentivize better against these, because, you know, it's a great first move, but guides don't scale and incentives do, right? That's what's going to be what motivates the leaders of these businesses who are in control and making those changes. So if we can start that conversation, then I think, you know, it's a starting point, but it might well lead to a much better longer term future for everyone.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you raise a good point. It would be great if we could do something sort of industry-wide that was for a much bigger strategic reason, you know, and had much greater strategic benefit to possibly all corners of the industry. And the reason I think it would be really important for us to try to do that now is because of what we saw happen in the US between X and GARM. You know, it was quite shocking to see the unfolding of that organisation so quickly, because it became such a litigious issue, and understandably the individuals and organisations involved just didn't want to be in that position. But there has to be a way for us to develop some kinds of, you know, sort of cross-industry, you know, unifying power that we can stand up to those sorts of challenges, and that it doesn't become a lawsuit between a multi-billionaire that runs a social media business and one or two individuals or a small defined, you know, not-for-profit organisation. There's got to be a way to try to develop the industry to a level of maturity that we can actually have those conversations at a reasonable point. You know, it feels like every other industry in the world has managed that. We should be able to manage that too. But perhaps that's for another day. I think we've run out of time. Thank you very much, Matt, for joining us on the MadTech podcast as a guest.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you very much, Luke. It was a delight to have you.
Well, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And that was this week's MadTech podcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the MadTech podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.